Good morning, Nexus friends, and welcome to another Sunday morning online, trucking through the fall, carrying on. Here we go. You know, last week we talked about poker and games, and I'm convinced that life is this mysterious and magical thing, and so often we lose sight of that. I mean, have you ever just paused and consider for a moment that we as humans, we play games? I mean, it's kind of odd when you stop and think about it. We like to play, which is funny when you entertain, consider that thought. We humans pause the regular flow of life to enter into these magical circles of play. Worlds, imaginary worlds with sets of rules and objective, these places of play where we suspend belief and enter into the alternate reality of a game. And this is a deep part of human nature. We have always been creatures who play. And even when games are infuriating to us, we consider them fun. Moreover, we humans, we take a lot of pride, don't we, in how well we play. There's a certain satisfaction, right, that comes from winning a game. Doesn't matter if it's poker, Monopoly, even Crokinole, right? We like to play, but we also like to be good at playing. We play for fun. We pride ourselves on winning, at excelling at fun, you could say. And so we take our playing very seriously. And the whole thing is just a quizzical delight to me. We humans truly are curious creatures. But is there something to be learned from our love of play and games? Are there echoes of spiritual truth to be found in our gameplay and what it does to us? I mean, consider someone I talked about last week, Maria Konnikova. And she's had me thinking about this recently because, you see, Maria studied at Harvard before earning her PhD in psychology at Columbia in 2013. Now, PhD in hand, she begins writing, publishing articles in journals, and before long, she publishes her first book, Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. And it's followed by her next book, The Confidence Game. And both of these go on to be New York Times bestsellers. And so to this point in her life, Konnikova's work was largely based around examining how the human mind responds to conditions that involve both skill and chance. And it seemed to her that these two things, skill and chance, they make up a lot of human existence, our experience. And so understanding these two forces in life seemed to her to be the key to living well, you could say. And though, of course, she's got this successful career in psychology and writing, she decides to put her career on hold for 3 years in order to learn to play. She decided to test herself at the game of poker, and when she started, she said she had no interest in gambling. She hated going into casinos. She couldn't even tell you how many cards were in a deck, and yet she threw herself into this game of play to see if she could master it. And if she came at poker, was the thought, if she came at it from a psychological perspective, maybe she could become a pro within a year. Now, it ended up taking her 3 years to become a pro, to win a championship. But in her book, The Biggest Bluff, she recounts how her gameplay journey and what it revealed about playing games and how it speaks heavily to the human condition, to faith, and for me, even what it means to walk the Jesus path. And so I just want to sort of unpack for us a few of the insights coming from Konnikova around what it means to play, what it means to be involved in games, and what it teaches us about life. And the first sort of lesson she sort of brings is this: games, like life, have a way of rattling us. And when we are rattled as humans, we tend to make poor decisions. In poker or other games, this mindset, this condition, is something called tilt. Let me give you an example. This summer, I was in Alberta visiting some friends, our family. We were staying with some friends out in Calgary. And these friends and I, we like to play Settlers of Catan. And so once the kids were in bed, it was game time. And so there we are, we're playing in the midst of the game. And, you know, I am, you know, quite well known as an expert in the game of Catan, of course. I think we all know that. But I'm in the middle of this game, and I've got this mitt full of cards, right? But I can't really do anything with them. I just got random cards, but I got a ton of them. And so I'm wondering what to do. And the person's turn right next to me, her name was Helen. She's wondering what she's going to do too. And she blurts out, oh, I've got so much ore I got to get rid of. And that's exactly what I needed. I knew I need to build cities if I'm going to win this game. And so her and I, we start trading. So I'm trading away my sheep, my brick, my wood. I'm giving it all to her in exchange for her ore. And I'm feeling great. By the end of our trade, a partnership, I have 6 ore and 4 wheat. I have enough when it comes to my turn to build 2 cities. When it's my turn, I am ready to go. The game is going to be mine. And just as I'm getting excited at the prospect of yet another win, what does Helen do but pull out a Monopoly card? And she says, I'm taking everyone's ore. My head almost exploded. She had set me up brilliantly. That Jezebel, she had traded her ore to me for all of my resources and then stolen it back. And in that moment, I could feel the game slipping out of my hands. She had taken me on a ride and just left me looking silly. And that's when things started getting crazy, because now I'm sort of losing my mind. I know I've been had. I start making poor decisions. I've completely lost track of the plot and my gameplay and what I'm focused on. I was trained for this, chased and longest road, doing anything I could, but it was all useless, and my decisions kept getting worse and worse and worse. And eventually, I lost. This sort of thing happens in games all the time. If you play poker long enough, you will see this in almost every single game. There's a moment where somebody will bet big on their hands and their cards are turned over and they've got the win, they've got it in their pocket, and then that river card comes and oh, they lose the pot. It was theirs and now it's gone, and you can see people's minds just shift. They've lost track of the plot line and now they keep making worse and worse decisions, losing more and more money. Maria Konnikova says this about tilt. If there's one thing that poker pros can agree upon, it's that tilt has taken down more poker players than anything else in history. Tilt is the state of mind where players become frustrated and mentally or emotionally confused and fatigued. Experiencing it can lead players to become overly aggressive. You'll be surprised how many pros practice getting out of poker tilt through real life tilt. Knowing when to walk away from a negative aspect of your life is the epitome of happiness and satisfaction. Games, like life, can rattle us, throws us into this mental state of tilt where we're frustrated, we're confused, we're fatigued, and we start making poorer and poorer decisions because we've lost track of the plot line. And as Maria explains, any game master, any pro, has to master the head game in order to find success. It's the same in life. We have to learn to keep the plot line in front of us, even when we're frustrated or weary or we've got that bad beat in life. To master games, to master life, you have to master the headspace. Know where your head is at, know when you are on tilt, and adjust. And I can't think of a time in my life where this might be more important than now, because today we live in a world, you could say, of bad beats, bad news. And the result is, I think most of us feel some level of fatigue these days, confusion, frustration. I mean, how could we not? We live in a world that feels like the whole world is on tilt. We live in this world of doom. Consider these words from Andrew Root. Even in my relatively short lifetime, there have been multiple existential threats to the West and modernity itself. To name just a few, I've been told to worry about nuclear holocaust, Y2K, financial collapse, Islamic terrorism, global warming, fake news, and a global pandemic. Those are only the major crises. News shows report hundreds, even thousands more crises. We have a child obesity crisis, a debt crisis, a housing bubble crisis, a bee crisis, an opioid crisis, a financial crisis, an antibiotic resistance crisis, an internet security crisis, and many more crises to concern us. Modernity is never absent pending doom. This is the age that we live in, the age of impending doom, you could say. We live in an environment that can rattle even the strongest of us, and it's doing something to our minds. Remember the definition of tilt. Tilt is the state of mind where players become frustrated, mentally or emotionally confused and fatigued. Let me ask you this question. Any of you feeling that? Feeling emotionally confused, fatigued, frustrated? I feel like all of us probably feel that to some extent or another, but it has a profound impact on us when we're in this emotional state, wrestling with it. What tends to happen in life, as in games, is we make poorer and poorer decisions. And as Maria reminds us, knowing when to walk away from a negative aspect of your life is the epitome of happiness and satisfaction. And that's the idea. Knowing when and how to walk away from the negative. In poker, when you're on tilt, what it means is you should either leave the table for a bit or just continue folding hands until you find some sort of equilibrium up here. And you know, the thing is, in life, we can't just walk away from this pandemic. There's some things that we can't just walk away from, close our eyes to, but others we can. And just because there are some things we can't control doesn't mean we have to feed those negative things in our lives. The recipe for success in games is keeping track of the plot line, not allowing our emotional state to ride the highs and lows of bad beats, but to stay focused, refuse to entertain or feed the negative. And you know, it reminds me a lot of Paul's words to the church in Philippi. He's writing to them and he reminds them towards the end of his letter this. Finally, beloved, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is pleasing, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence and if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. Keep on doing the things that you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, and the God of peace will be with you. The God of peace is with us, in particular when we refuse to feed the trolls, when we refuse to feed the negative and allow that to dictate our plot lines. We have to refuse to give in to the negative these days, refuse to indulge in it. Instead, focus on where the plot line is. And in a time like ours, I think we would all do well to remember to concentrate, as Paul says, on what is good and true and commendable. The second lesson is this: know what you want. You know, in the Gospel of John, Jesus' very first words in that gospel, they come, as perhaps should not be a surprise, they come by way of question. Jesus' first words in the gospel are actually a question. And I find this exchange with Jesus both funny and telling. Here's how it goes down. The next day, John the Baptist was there again with his two disciples. And when he saw Jesus passing by, he said, "Look, the Lamb of God." When the two disciples heard him say this, they followed Jesus. And turning around, Jesus saw them following and asked, "What do you want?" And they said, "Rabbi, where are you staying?" "Come," he replied, "and you will see." Fascinating question. What do you want? What do you really want? And you know, in the story, you get the sense that these disciples are caught off guard by the question, right? Like they don't really know how to respond. It's like, "What do you want? I don't know. Where are you staying?" It's kind of a silly question. They don't know what they want from Jesus. They don't know what they want. They just know that they find this Jesus compelling. There's a certain hope in him. But as for what they really want, they're not quite sure. And you know, so often I think it's the same for us. We don't know what we really want. And you know, Jesus' response to these confused disciples is that the answer to what they want will be found eventually in following him. And though they might not be able to articulate it yet with their minds, though they might be confused, Jesus' response to them is, "Okay, well, come and follow me." And so to follow Jesus is to confront truth and have our wants exposed, challenged, and reshaped. That question from Jesus echoes through the centuries down to us this morning. What do you want? For those of us traveling the Christian path, what do you really want? What do you want from Jesus? What do you want from life, from faith, from relationships? What do you want? Can you even answer that question? Can I? And the challenge, I think, for many of us today is that we're confused about what we truly want in life. And if there's anything that exposes this to us, it's games. Games have a way of exposing to us that we're confused about our wants. Way back in the early days of Nexus, we had ourselves a game day, a tabletop game day, and oh, was it ever fun and exciting. And I found myself at a table playing Settlers with the good Sir Brian Garden. What a wonderful fellow this guy is, right? Anyone who knows Brian knows there's so much to love about him. And yet I would learn that day, this man, this lovable man, is also very confused. You see, Brian and I sat down at the Settlers' tables with two other people, and Brian was confident, right? He declared his intention to win. He was going to win the game of Settlers, but as the game progressed, he realized the man, he was torn. There was a wrestle inside of him. You see, what happened is this, is I, for some mysterious reason, was a bit of a non-factor in this game. I mean, that's pretty rare, but it happens from time to time. So I was sitting in the middle of this game at 3 points. Now, you got to get to 10 in Settlers. And another player at the table was at 5 points. And the leader was at 7 points. And Brian was at 6 points. It's Brian's turn. He rolls the dice and up comes a seven. Now, in Settlers, a seven, of course, means that you get to move the robber, put it on someone's resources, rob them of that, and then you get to take a card from them. Now, any rational player who wanted to win this game of Settlers would have seen the obvious move. The only rational move would be to put it on the player who's in the lead with 7 points. That's the optimal strategy, you could say, for playing this game. You attack those who are your closest competitors. But I could see this moment where Brian picked up the robber and his mind was rattled. He picked it up and he put it on me. Devious little fella. Because you see, what happened at this table was this. When Brian sat down at the table, he thought what he wanted was to win. But what he realized in that moment is that what he really wanted, what he wanted even more than winning himself, was to see me lose. Now, in game theory, this is called utility maximizers, which is just a fancy way of saying this. If you've got two choices in front of you, generally you're going to pick the one that makes you most happy, you could say. You will take the choice that benefits you most. But here's the thing. We are so often confused about what will actually make us happy, what will actually get us ahead. Because oftentimes in life, we choose things that don't work towards winning or being healthy or happy or content in life. So often in life, we choose those things that don't make us faith-filled, authentic human beings. So often we choose the path of self-destruction, like taking a less than optimal strategy with the robbery, like Brian did, purely out of spite and jealousy. And what is most scary in these moments, whether it's in a game like that or in life, is that when we have these moments, when we pick that less than optimal thing, is it reminds us that maybe these aren't just mistakes we are making, but they actually reflect our deepest wants and desires, because sometimes what we truly want are the things that aren't best for us. Choices reveal our true wants. I mean, ask yourself this, if a game theorist were to follow you around for the span of an entire week, what would they say your choices reveal about you and what you want in life? And you see, this is the thing to me about following the Jesus path. Jesus doesn't start by telling people, listen, your wants are wrong. What Jesus starts with is just a question. What do you want? You see, Jesus isn't looking for piety. Jesus is looking for honesty. He's looking for us to tap into and truly explore what we want in life. We don't have to play games, you could say, with Jesus. It's okay on the Jesus path to start with all of our petty, deep desires and wants. To follow Jesus is to confront truth and have our wants exposed, challenged, and reshaped. And the funny thing is, you see this happen within Jesus' own ranks, within Jesus' own followers. They begin to follow Jesus around because they sense in him that he has life and love and light. But it isn't long before their true wants are exposed and revealed. I mean, at one point, the disciple James and John, the son of Zebedee, they really spill it out. They're like, listen, straight up, here's what we want. We want to sit on your right and on your left when you become king. What we really want, Jesus, is proximity to power, fame, a platform. And the interesting thing to me is this, Jesus doesn't kick them out for wanting the wrong things. Rather, instead, he suggests that maybe they don't truly understand what they want in life and where that will lead them. In either case, they expose their true wants, and Jesus' coaching is to keep following, because to follow Jesus is to eventually have our wants, our true wants, exposed, but then challenged and reshaped. But the first step in an authentic faith journey is not trying to play pious, but to be completely honest. What do we want? Third idea, you see, when Maria Konnikova first started her journey with poker, the very first thing she did was enlist herself the help of a mentor. And she was able to make her mentor, Eric Seidel. He's one of the most decorated professional poker players in the world. And so he became her mentor. And one of his first pieces of advice to her in poker was this: less certainty, more inquiry. I find that fascinating, because here's the thing about the game of poker. In poker, you can never truly know or have certainty. You never know what cards that other person or people are holding. And one of the greatest temptations in poker, right, is to play the really conservative game. Just sit and wait. Wait until you're 100% certain that you have the best hand. The problem is that kind of certainty rarely comes along. And that trouble is that when it comes along so rarely like that, if you choose to wait until you're certain, you'll end up losing in the long run, slowly bleeding away your chip stack. Konnikova says this: poker isn't just about calibrating the strength of your beliefs. It's also about becoming comfortable with the fact that there's no such thing as a sure thing, ever. You will never have all the information you want, and you will have to act all the same. Leave your certainty at the door. I love that. You will never have certainty, but you have to act all the same. Now, just change one word in that quote from hers, and I think, my goodness, does it ever preach. Faith isn't just about calibrating the strength of your beliefs. It's also about becoming comfortable with the fact that there's no such thing as a sure thing, ever. You will never have all the information you want, and you will have to act all the same. Leave your certainty at the door. This is such a tremendous piece of advice, I think, for any person of faith. I absolutely love it. You're never going to have all the information. You're never going to have all the answers to all the doubts you have about faith. You'll never have all the information, but you still have to act anyway. You know, it's interesting, because today I feel like the temperature within the church is more and more people are on board with this less certainty idea. But what I find lacking a lot of times is the second part of the advice: less certainty, but also more inquiry. And you see, the reason that Eric gave this piece of advice to Maria was this, is he tried to frame it for her in psychological terms, Sherlock Holmes terms. She had written that book, because what he told her was this: listen, everyone at a poker table is telling a story. And that story could be told through their body language, their bets, but everything about a person at a poker table is telling a story. Your task is to figure out what story they're telling. And for Maria, the advice was, you have to inquire more of people. Every part of the game is trying to figure out the story, their body language, everything. And so more inquiry, more investigation, trying to figure out, what does that small detail there mean? What does that little twitch before they bet mean? Why did they bet big preflop and then just check when the fold came? What story are the people at the table telling? And I would suggest it's the same with faith. It's the same for us who walk the Jesus path. Less certainty, yes, but also more inquiry, more examination, more investigation. Leave certainty at the door, but we have a lot of work to do with inquiring more, becoming curious. Ask better faith questions and try to figure out the story being told and our place in it. And you know, I can't wait to get to this because next Sunday I want to take this concept in particular and sort of develop it further with a sermon about scripture. But we'll get to that next week. But this idea really resonates with me, particularly related to faith. Less certainty, more inquiry. A desire to figure out the story, the grand story we find ourselves in. That, to me, is one of the central tasks of the Jesus path. But finally, the best piece of advice Konnikova ever received on poker was this. It was from a person named Mike Caro, who says this: what is the object of poker? Some will say winning money or winning lots of pots, but no. The object of poker is making good decisions. This was the piece of advice that really propelled her vision of becoming a poker pro. Instead of aiming to win, there's so much pressure with that, every hand became, what is the wise decision to make here? She turned her game from, I must win, to how do I make the best decisions? And it worked a lot of the time. It helped her develop patience and skill. It helped her know when to fold and when to play something. And eventually, lots of time, effort, practice, she won a championship. But she also lost a lot of games and tournaments. And while this piece of advice was helpful for her, she later reflected on just the cutthroat nature of poker. Because she realized this, despite winning, there were many times for her when she played or she felt like she played basically a perfect game. She made wise decisions hour after hour after hour. But as every poker player knows, all it takes is one mistake. One mess up, it can cost you a whole game. You know, I think it's the same in life. We can make wise, just, loving decisions 99% of the time. And yet you can make one mistake and it costs you dearly in life. You can be the wisest, most sound decision-making person, but all it takes is once. One too many drinks, that one moment of inattention, that one wrongly worded tweet or email, that one moment of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, that one silly decision you make about your marriage, your career, all it takes is one mistake in life to cost us dearly. And I would say this, life, like poker, is for sure about learning to make good and wise decisions. That seems reasonable. That's sound advice. But what all of us know is this, none of us can make wise decisions all the time. And you see, to me, this is where the fundamental rules of the game part ways between poker and the Jesus path. You see, poker is a system, a game where mistakes cost you. There's no mercy, no grace, no pardon. Mess up, make a bad decision, make a mistake, it will cost you. The cards don't care about you. Make the wrong call and you will live with the consequences. But the Jesus path offers us something different. It offers us a baseline, deeper set of truths about the nature of the game of life, you could say. I like what Derek Freeland offers here. I am kind most of the time. I am motivated most of the time. I am my best self most of the time. But most of the time is why I need mercy all of the time. You see, try as we might, we can't play the game of our lives as our best selves all the time. It's simply impossible. We're human, we're finite. Eventually, all of us grow fatigued, confused, tired, and when we do, we end up making mistakes. In poker and in life, we have to live with the consequences of those decisions. But what the Jesus path teaches us is that our system, the world we believe we live in, where the rules are made up of skill, chance, action, and consequence, that's not actually the deepest set of rules about our cosmos. The final word, the baseline set of rules in the cosmos that Jesus now reigns from because of the cross is mercy, pardon, forgiveness, grace. You know, last Sunday morning at the Conrad Center when we were live, we actually, to demonstrate this, we had a live poker game. And it was phenomenal. We had six players around a table all making bets. But a final sort of bet came in. Somebody went all in on their set of cards. And of course, we weren't playing a three-hour game of poker. It was condensed time. And obviously, I think because of the crunch nature of time, four people from that table went all in, and they were playing with real money because that's the, that's the nature of poker. Real money, you got to have skin in the game, and it comes with consequences. So two people folded, and four people were all in, each of them for $20, and the cards were turned over, and the winner turned out to be Mary Affable. She won herself a cool $80. It was amazing, sort of living parable illustration of having skin in the game. But at the end of Sunday morning, I went to her to cash out her money, give her money, and she simply said, "I can't do it, Brad. Give everyone back their money." You know, it's interesting. It's such a perfect metaphor for me, because I was trying to illustrate last week skin in the game, and that comes with consequences. And yet Mary plays the Christ figure and says, yes, that's how poker works. That's how life works. But Jesus' kingdom works differently. The final word isn't action and consequence. The final word is grace. And so everyone received their money back at the end of the morning. It was just perfect. And you see, life, in my estimation, truly is like a game. You learn, you grow, hopefully over time, you learn to make wiser and wiser decisions. And you realize, of course, when you understand the nature of skill and chance, you learn that a lot of what we've gained or achieved in life is, like most games, a combination of skill and luck. And like games, we come to understand that in life, mistakes can be costly. And yet, what the Jesus path offers us, what it's whispering, is that there's a glitch in the matrix. We might think that life is governed by skill and chance. We might think that at the root of things, life is bare minimum, a set of actions and consequences. But the deeper truth of the cosmos, the Jesus path tells us, is that beyond skill, beyond chance, beyond action and consequence is a deeper magic, a deeper set of rules, and it's called grace. And the testimony of grace is this: our identity and our fate, at the end of the day, it's not governed by how much skill we have. It's not governed completely by luck of the draw. Our identity and fate is not defined by the amount of good choices we make in comparison to our mistakes. No. Our fate and identity is governed by grace, and grace alone. As we end this morning, if you have communion elements with you, go ahead and get some wine, bread, wine substitutes. On your own this morning, take some time, pause, consider, allow the bread and wine to be a reminder to you that we don't live in a closed system universe that's governed by skill, chance, action, and consequence. But at the end of the day, we believe in a God of grace. And grace always has the final word. As you take the elements, remember Jesus on the night he was betrayed, took the bread, took the cup, and then he said to his disciples, "Take this bread and eat. This is my body. Do this in remembrance of me." And then he took the cup and he said, "Take, drink. This is my blood shed for you." This morning, as you take the communion elements on your own, give yourself some time to reflect on the nature of life, the nature of games, and the beauty of living in a cosmos that is ultimately structured around grace. Friends, thanks for joining us again this morning. I hope you have a terrific weekend. Until next Sunday, go in peace.